everyone. We're so thrilled to see all of you here today. Thank you very much for joining us. My name is Kathleen Massey. I am one of the people who is responsible for recruitment and admissions. My role is Registrar and Executive Director of Enrollment Services at McGill. I am so pleased to welcome you to our keynote talk today. And I have a couple of requests to make. It's going to be, I think, a very intimate opportunity for you to speak to what I'm now referring to as a NASA family and the Feustels. But I have a couple of requests to make. One is, you already have the bathroom information. I heard that a moment ago. But one is, if you have questions, these mics are terrific. All you need to do is press the button until you see a red light underneath, and then you can speak. And then when you're finished speaking, kindly press it again, and then it'll stop recording. And the other is that I wanted to let you know that today's session is being recorded so that other people who couldn't make it today have the benefit of hearing the talks. And one final request, I know how urgently many of us, how many other urgent priorities we have, but it would be lovely if, because we're recording today's session, you could put your phone on silent or buzzer for the duration of the talk. That would be really helpful for us. I hope you have a wonderful day here at McGill. I'll be emceeing this event throughout the talk, and with that, I'd like to introduce the new Deputy Provost Student Life and Learning at McGill, who is bringing a vision of innovation, creativity, and change to our work. He's a professor, and I would like to welcome Professor Olivier Dience.
Thanks, Kathleen. Kathleen just mentioned innovation and vision. It's really hard for me to talk about innovation and vision when there's an astronaut next to me. I also said I'm going to dress up well today, and then I saw Dr. Feustel with his uniform, and then I feel really lame with my three-piece suit. I'm not going to speak for very long because, of course, you're not here to listen to me, but I've just started McGill about 2 months ago. This is about, I'm saying, between my degrees and the workplace I worked. This is about my eighth institution that I've worked in, higher education, and this is by far the best and most exciting institution I've ever seen. This is a great institution. It's going to stimulate you, and it's going to challenge you. It's an extremely demanding institution. It's extremely difficult to get into McGill, and the competition is ferocious. But that's what we want, and that's what our students want, and that's what our faculty members want. And this is what we're going to, you know, this is what we're thriving for, and we're going to make it really stimulating. My role as deputy provost, I'm not going to speak too long about this, but my role as a deputy provost is to ensure that we create the student life and learning, so it's to ensure that we create the best, healthiest, and most stimulating environment in campus life for students to be able to thrive in the classroom, because that's what's most important for students. So we're trying very hard to do so. So this being said, let me now introduce the Feustels. It's a great honor for me to introduce the Feustels, and it is, I feel like a kid, right, in front of an astronaut. Really, and I do have to, it's not in my speech, of course, but I do have to ask Dr. Feustel, how true to your experience is the film Gravity? Right? I just saw Gravity, and I know there was a lot of articles about it, and that said, well, it's so true, that's not true, and I said, I don't want to read any of this, because it does feel pretty cool, right? So, again, it's an honor for me to introduce the Feustels, Drew and Indra Feustels, to McGill, and to thank them for taking the time to share their experience with us. For those of you who are space buffs, you probably know of Dr. Feustel's remarkable achievement as a NASA astronaut. In 2009, Dr. Feustel served on the crew of Space Shuttle Atlantis, flight STS-125, the final space shuttle mission to the Hubble Space Telescope. The mission has successfully extended and improved the observatory capabilities through 2014. Flight STS-125 Atlantis was the fifth and final Hubble servicing mission. The telescope spent 6 days in the shuttle cargo bay undergoing an overhaul conducted by four space walkers, of course, because I'm French, the first time I read it, I read Sleepwalkers. But it's four spacewalkers over five daily spacewalks with the assistance of crewmates inside Atlantis. Among the challenges, the spacewalkers overcame frozen bolts, strip screws, and stuck handrails. sounds really scary when you're in space. In 2011, Dr. Foisil served as the lead spacewalker on flight, this time STS-134. This was the penultimate mission of NASA's Space Shuttle program. The mission marked the final flight of Space Shuttle Endeavour. This flight delivered the Atlantic Magnetic Spectrometer and an express logistic carrier to the International Space Station. Now, you may not know this about Drew Feistel, but he is also a geophysicist by profession. He earned his Bachelor's of Science in Solid Earth Sciences from Purdue University, a Master of Science in Geophysics also from Purdue University, and a PhD in Geological Sciences, specializing in seismology from Queen's University here in Canada, in Kingston, and that he, along with his wife Indra, are parents of a proud McGill student, and we're really proud of that. And Indra Fostol is a McGill alumna. This is getting better and better. She graduated with a Bachelor of Science in Psychology and will speak to you today about what a McGill degree means to both her and their son, and also the challenges associated with being an astronaut family and what it meant to them as a family to send their son away here at McGill in Montreal, in this amazing institution, in this very, very, very exciting city also. So without further delay, I turn the floor over. Please join me in welcoming the Fostols. Thank you.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you for joining us. Drew and I would like to extend our deep gratitude and thanks to Kathleen Massey, Deborah Dimitrik, and Jocelyn Yunan for inviting us to participate in this year's McGill's Open House. We are so excited to be back, and especially for me, you know, being a McGill alumna, we're just so thankful. Thank you. Drew and I will be happy to answer any questions you may have about our experiences and our challenges as an astronaut family, but I also offer the dual perspective of being a former McGill student and a McGill parent. I'm going to share with you a little about the path we took to get here today. It all started with a television program. It was Cornwall, Ontario, where I was growing up, and I was very young. My dad and I were watching a news program when all of a sudden McGill showed up on the screen, and my dad excitedly, and I think I was about 8 years old, excitedly exclaimed, "Indy, Indy, this is McGill. McGill is the best school in the country." And I took mental note that day, and I thought, if my dad says it's the best, I'm going to go there. And originally from India and the Czech Republic, my parents had very high academic expectations. So naturally, I became a very diligent student. And I had a clear goal in mind. I was going to go to McGill University. I had arrived. And so here I am at McGill, my dream school, on the front steps of this very building. And I know you can probably tell by the clothes I'm wearing, it was circa 1985. And so I loved it here. I made friends for life here. Yeah, I get a little emotional. A world-renowned school in a fabulous city. Everyone will tell you that. And so what's not to love, right? I loved it so much that I actually wanted to stay here to complete my master's in speech-language pathology. So I walked over to the Communication Sciences and Disorders Department and met with the director. I asked him what my chances were for getting into the master's program here. And it's important to note that I had studied and worked very hard during my 3 years here at McGill. My diligence had not wavered. Overall, I had great grades, I thought, and, you know, they weren't all A's, but I was happy with them. And so when I told the director my grades, he looked at me and in a very straightforward manner, very matter-of-factly, said, "If you don't have straight A's, you won't get in." No sugarcoating, no sliver of hope. I will admit that my walk home, I was full of tears, but... out of the seven speech-language pathology master's programs in Canada, and yes, seven, that's very selective, I didn't get into any of them. At least that's how I remember it. Remember, I had decent grades at McGill, and I know this doesn't sound like a resounding endorsement for McGill right now. It is. The best is yet to come. I ended up applying to what felt like 100 schools in the U.S. It was probably more like 20. And here's the kicker. I got into every one of those schools, and not only that, I started getting offers of scholarship and in the form of teaching assistant positions. Here's the best part. I was now being recruited by Purdue University. It was one of the top five programs in the nation. We're not talking seven schools. There are tons of speech-language pathology schools in the U.S. So what a strange turn of events. Not being accepted into any of the programs in Canada for my master's program, but being accepted into all of the U.S. schools and being now recruited by a top-ranked school in the U.S. So why do you think that was? And of course, it was because of McGill's reputation for providing their students with such an excellent education. So thank you, McGill, and thank you to our Governor General of Canada. Do I need to do this?
No.
Okay. So thank you to our former, our Governor General of Canada, our former McGill Principal, David Johnston. And after 3 years at McGill University, I graduated with my Bachelor of Science in Psychology. And in addition to being a McGill Redman, which you are for life, I now added becoming a Purdue Boilermaker. I can do this. Do you want me to do it?
Okay.
We make a great team. So
we're improvising now.
At Purdue, in addition to my studies, I worked as a residence hall counselor there. And as an added bonus, I met my future husband there, a fellow residence hall counselor, Drew Feustel, who claims that when we began dating, that he told me he wanted to be an astronaut. I honestly do not remember that. But in spite of that, we got married in 1990 and then graduated in 1991. And at the time, I was homesick for all things Canadian. So I was really hoping that we would come back up to McGill and Montreal, and Drew would complete his PhD there. However, due to an academic connection that he had, we ended up moving to Kingston, where he did his completed his PhD there. So we moved to Kingston, where I started working on a traumatic brain injury team at Kingston General Hospital. Then, some very special things happened in our lives. In 1994 and 1996, 2 years apart to the day, two future McGillians were born. Ari Frischer, who's now 19 years old and in second year of his engineering program, and Aiden, who's 17 and who's diligently working on his entrance applications like some of you are as we speak. So crossing our fingers. So, okay, you might some of you might call it brainwashing when your two sons want to come to your alma mater. So I actually asked Aiden about this right before I left. I said, Aiden, what do you say to that? He said, Mom, you've taken us to Montreal and McGill our entire lives. We've grown to love it. And I thought, much better than saying, you've brainwashed us, Mom. Okay, so back to Kingston. We were Kingston from space.
I took that picture.
So we were happy. I was nesting, you saw the picture of the boys. We had our first home there and, loved my job, my colleagues. We were close to family and friends. I mean, I grew up in Cornwall, brother in Ottawa, family, and, we're in Kingston. So we're like a triangle away from each other, less than 2 hours apart. And all our friends, very close. Drew's family, close enough. So,
it's always like that.
So anyway, and then the call came. Okay, so Drew was being recruited to work for ExxonMobil in Houston, Texas. okay? So not so close, by one of his Purdue friends. And after lengthy discussions, we decided to go to Houston for a year. I figured we can do anything for a year. So, and my work was being wonderful. They let me take a year's leave of absence. Well, that was 1997, and in the year 2000, it became Drew was selected as an astronaut, and it became clear that we were going to be in Houston for a little while. And it, so far, it's been 16 years. So, maintaining, obviously, maintaining my Canadian roots and identity was very important to me. As it was, I wanted that for the boys. And Drew, being a dual citizen as well, I don't know if some of you know, he's Canadian as well, we kind of came up with a deal. So I was bringing up the boys every summer to Ontario and Quebec, and for many winter vacations as well. So it was important to me that and us that we that the boys knew how to skate and ski and make snow angels, and of course the fine art of catching snowflakes on your tongue. And then, so then back to Houston. The major highlights of our time there were obviously Drew's space shuttle missions. And as a family, we waited 9 years for his first space shuttle mission on Space Shuttle Atlantis, STS-125. And he was going up to help prepare the Hubble Space Telescope. And here we are in 2009 waiting to watch the shuttle launch. And as I look at this photo, I feel absolutely blessed that the boys were the ages that they were, because they have this memory for life. You know, some of the astronaut children might not have been born yet or were babies, so that's what I feel blessed for. Also, when you look at this, this is definitely the fear of the unknown. Sort of, I see moms out there, right? Just like pregnancy, the fear of the unknown. Just like you prospective students going off to university, the fear of the unknown. And parents, I know how you're feeling, sending off your kids to university, fear of the unknown. Okay, so in this photo, it's May 2011, and we're waiting for Drew's second launch on STS-134, and this time on Space Shuttle Endeavour. And now, it's the fear of the known. So when your husband, and for, in the case of my boys, sit on all that rocket fuel, okay, knowing what can go wrong, it can be overwhelming and stressful, to say the least. But then you have to have faith. And you might not breathe for what seems like an eternity, but from a very deep place within, you let out the biggest guttural woohoo ever, and are grateful that the launch went flawlessly. And this is what relief and happiness looks like. As for those of you that have seen the movie Gravity know, not so nice things can happen in space. So we weren't in the clear. We didn't have Drew back home with us yet. But for now, relief and contentment. So here you see Ari and Aiden during Parents' Weekend, or sorry, Ari and I during Parents' Weekend in front of the Arts Building last August 2012, 28 years since I had arrived, and that went like this. And hopefully, in another year, we'll be able to take a similar photo with Aiden, making it three McGillions in the family. And I'm certain it's not a record breaker, but it's a nice family tradition to start. And I know I have some nieces and nephews in the audience, so hoping. We're very proud of Ari making it into this prestigious university, and for all his accomplishments. And as busy as he was, upon my request, he provided some helpful tips for the prospective students. So we'll leave that up for a few moments, and we can also put them back up at the end of the presentation for an additional look. And I want to leave with you this final image, and I know we've all felt this way at one point in our lives, and if you haven't yet, you will. Trust me. And of course, I look at this image and I see Ari and Aiden flapping their wings, yelling, "Woo, yahoo! We're on our own. Here we come, world." And you know, while Dad and I are inside, you know, hearts welling with pride, eyes welling with tears because we miss them already. But good luck to all you future students. Flap your wings like you've never flapped before. Fly well. You'll do great. And parents, I know how you're feeling, and it'll all work out. Trust me. And thank you very much for having us here today.
Well, that was awesome. Thank you, honey. Can you hear me okay in the back, though? For those of you who are wondering, I wasn't texting while I was up here doing email. I was actually controlling the slideshow. Sometimes that works, sometimes it doesn't, so we'll keep our fingers crossed. I'll talk a little bit about what I did, and Indra already talked about why we were here, and so I think you have an idea of what we're trying to convey. We want to talk about the school, what its relationship was to us, but also Miguel has a lot of connections to the space program, and I'm really just going to talk to you about my experiences in flight and some of the things that I do as an astronaut in training and what we all have to look forward to in the future. So as was mentioned, I grew up in Detroit in the Motor City. I'm a bit of a car nut, so I'm a mechanic on the side as well as being a seismologist, but also now a geologist. When I left, I'm also now an astronaut, right? When I left high school, I went to community college for 3 years and worked as a mechanic and got an associate science degree, and I did that before I went off to Purdue University. Stayed at Purdue for a few more years to get my undergraduate degree, then my master's, and met my wife at Purdue, and then we traveled to Kingston. And, of course, finished my PhD in seismology, worked in industry for a few years, and was picked up by NASA in the year 2000. So I've been an astronaut for 13 years and have flown on two space shuttle missions, one to the Hubble Space Telescope, as we talked about, and one to the International Space Station. So I've been very lucky with those experiences that I've had in space. But I'll talk a little bit about the training that we do as astronauts in preparing for space flight. We do a lot of different things. Really, the goal at the Johnson Space Center for all of us is to not only prepare ourselves to go into space, but prepare others to go into space. So now that I'm a veteran space flyer, one of my job's primary roles is to get others ready to fly. And we do that by basically traveling around the world and looking for environments that we consider to be analogs for space. For example, this habitat in Florida off the Florida Keys is 60 feet below the surface of the water, and we spend a week or two at a time as astronauts, as groups of scientists down here, carrying out experiments and techniques and activities that emulate spaceflight. It's a very hostile environment living in this. We can't go outside. Just like in space, we can't go outside with specialized equipment. Same is true here. We can't go out into the water unless we're wearing all our scuba gear and equipment and have constant communication with people in the control room. So we look for space analogs. Another one, this photo is taken from an underground cave in Sardinia. We spend time together in groups working in stressful places where we still have objectives and tasks that we have to achieve every day. So we try to learn to work together as a team just like we would do in space. This is a cold weather training exercise that was actually done up in Valcartier, up in Quebec at the Canadian Forces Base. And this was several years back, but again, stressful environment, minus 35 degrees. We've got things to do every day, move camp, work together as a team. It's kind of like camping, or for those of you that are field scientists where you go out and you have work to do. There's always something to do every day, but you got to take care of the nominal things as well. So you're trying to get your objectives done. Again, an analog for spaceflight. And if you look closely in this picture, many of you know Chris Hadfield. He's the guy at the back pushing the sled. So we're all out here working hard, but Chris was out there with us as well. And then the other thing we do is we fly high-performance jet aircraft, and that's another way for us to practice crew coordination between the front seater and the back seater, team coordination between multiple jets, and carrying out missions each day and having objectives that we have to attain, places that we need to go, but working together as a team. All of this we consider to be part of spaceflight readiness training. And the reason we do it is we're trying to explore. And we're exploring two things, essentially, right now in space. We're exploring Earth from space, and we're exploring space from space. And so that's what we do at the Johnson Space Center. That's what Human Spaceflight Program is about, learning to work and live in space for extended periods of time. And so I'm going to talk a little bit about my two missions. We'll talk about the Hubble mission first and follow it up with STS-134, which was the second-to-last space shuttle mission in history, the last flight of space shuttle Endeavour. So on STS-125, launched in May of 2009, so this is a great photo, pretty close. My family, of course, was about 3 miles away watching the launch. We blasted off early in the day and rocketed off towards space on our 8-minute ride up into about 200 miles up. And the destination that day was the Hubble Space Telescope. It took us about 3 days to catch up to it, but this is what it looks like floating above the planet. This is about 600 kilometers up above the surface of the Earth. It's about the size of a school bus, and it just floats up there all on its own. And it's not big like the space station. There's nowhere to go when you get to it. You just arrive at the Hubble Space Telescope. And this is the crew that went to space. 7 of us, 4 rookies and 3 veteran space flyers, all ready to go and get to work. You can see we're pretty happy here, because if you're not smiling when you're in space, you're probably doing something wrong, because it's just a glorious place to be. First thing we did was got to work, and Megan MacArthur, our robotic arm operator using Canada Arm 1, which lived on all the space shuttles, reached out and grabbed the Hubble Space Telescope with that arm and set it in the back of the space shuttle cargo bay. So you think of the space shuttle kind of like a pickup truck with the back bed open, and our job was to place the telescope back there, and then each day we'd have to go outside and get to work. And if you look closely, there's actually an astronaut's boots sticking out back here and another guy in the arm. And we essentially opened up the telescope and carried out activities over a 5-day period. And you can see in the lighted section of this image is actually the light shine on the Earth. So there's the darkness is where the sun is passive of the Earth. The light side is where the sun is still shining on it. And the views are just magnificent from space. It actually makes it really hard to get anything done, because, you know, you're just hard to keep your concentration when you see Hawaii going by down below, or some part of the planet, you know, crossing continents in a matter of minutes. It's just amazing. So we performed 5 spacewalks on that mission, all back-to-back, which means every day a team of 2 spacewalkers went outside. And so we had 2 teams of 2. When myself and John Grunsfeld were outside, the other team was inside choreographing the spaceflight for us, basically reading us the playbook, working us through the day. Those suits weigh 300 pounds on Earth, but in space they're pretty much weightless, which is a good thing. But this is our personal spaceship. This is what keeps us alive in space. And supplies oxygen for us to breathe. And so we had we spend about 8 hours in these suits when we go out to work, with 2 liters of water inside. And you tend to miss lunch when you're outside working, but you know, you got to get the job done. We spent 3 years training for this mission. It was the last time astronauts were going to visit the Hubble Space Telescope. And I think in the introduction, Olivier mentioned we extended the Hubble life till 2014, but that was the designed extension. That's because we had to have a specific number that they thought the batteries that we installed would last until. But the reality is we hope that the Hubble Space Telescope continues to work for at least another 10 years. We really don't know. Astronauts will likely never visit Hubble again, but as some of you might know already, Hubble has really revealed some amazing secrets about the universe and shown us so much about the stars and the solar system and the universe that we've just never believed were possible. So there is time to mess around a little bit up there, and I haven't dug this photo out in a long time, but these are little cookies that we got that Canada sent up with us, the little maple leaf cookies, quite delicious, and you can have a lot of fun with food, floating stuff around in space, and this was my chance to try to capture one of those cookies. This is why we went to repair the Hubble Space Telescope, because of the images that it shows us about the universe. I mean, there's magic things in space that we can only dream about, but Hubble has this amazing ability to bring those pictures home to us and really show us what the structure and the makeup is of the universe. This star field, for example, I mean, it's just stunning. Have you ever looked up in the night sky and seen this many stars? We can't. It's not possible from Earth. What's even more amazing about this photo is that if you were to hold your thumb up to the night sky, you would be covering all these stars with your thumb. So imagine that these stars are up there behind your thumb and everywhere else around you, all around the whole planet. I mean, they're just everywhere. So this is why it was important for us to go and repair Hubble, because this sort of information is critical to our understanding as humans of where we're from, where we're headed, what makes up our universe. So that was a really quick recap of a very important space mission back in 2009, but we hope that the legacy of Hubble will live on and on for decades. I'm sure the scientific information coming from it will last probably several lifetimes. The next mission I want to talk about is STS-134. This was my, I don't want to say my last space mission, because hopefully it was my most recent space mission. But this was, we flew this in 2011 with six astronauts, all veteran space flyers at this point. And this is where we were auditioning for the Star Trek, new Star Trek movie, before they actually released that movie. But this was our crew, all veterans. Our commander was Mark Kelly. Many of you will remember that he's the husband of Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords, who was actually shot about 5 months before our mission launched into space. And we were fortunate that Mark was still able to join us on the mission. We spent 2 years training for this flight, and we would have had some significant challenges if Mark wasn't able to join us. Fortunately, he was, and Congresswoman Giffords is doing much better these days than certainly than she was then. But we had a wonderful flight. This is a great photo that was taken by a fighter aircraft that was doing surveillance and reconnaissance during our mission as we launched. And we're probably at about Mach 2 here, trying to get to Mach 25 or 25 times the speed of sound as we blast off into space. Again, I don't know if you remember what I said. It's an 8-minute ride to space. So when you blast off, it's the most exhilarating ride of your life. You're sitting there laying on your back, and a lot of things are going through your mind. And you can just imagine, right? So you're laying flat on your back, and I flew on the mid-deck of the space shuttle, which means the ground floor. As a spacewalker, I don't have as much time as the guys that are pilots and commanders to attend the simulations for launch and landing, because I spend a lot of time in the neutral buoyancy laboratory training to do spacewalks. So my task was to go up and do spacewalks, which means I get to ride on the bottom floor of the space shuttle, which means you can't see anything. There's no windows. So you're sitting in there. It's like sitting in a closet with two other crew members laying on your back, and you can hear the countdown. And they're at like 3 minutes. And you think, oh, 3 minutes, you know, we might go to space today, because they can cancel the launch up until about the last 6 seconds. And then eventually gets down to 1 minute, and you're thinking, okay, you know, this is getting exciting. I know what's going to happen. They're going to launch a space shuttle next, maybe if we're lucky. When the countdown gets to 10, then you start questioning whether you made the right decisions in your life, if you should be sitting on top of the rocket fuel that Indy mentioned. And then they get to 6, and the main engines of the shuttle light. So this is before the boosters go off, but then the shuttle engines light, and you can feel the whole rocket start to weave back and forth. We're about 200 feet off the launch pad. We're at the top. The motors are at the bottom. So when the engines light, everything starts to weave back and forth. And then they get to 0. And the next thing that happens is you feel like somebody just ran into the back of your chair with a pickup truck. It's extremely violent. It's just like a smack in the back. And the first thing I thought of was, I sure as hell hope this rocket knows where it's going, because we are not staying on the planet anymore. Because immediately clear, you are just going, and you're going off into space. And that's the only thing you're just hoping, is that I really hope that this thing knows what it's doing, because you're not in control, and fate's taken over. And, you know, you don't know what's going to happen. You got 8 minutes to make it to space, and you're keeping your fingers crossed. But it's an amazing ride. I can tell you that about this point in the flight, we got smiles from one ear to the other, and you know, you're just thumbs up with the guy next to you and screaming all the way. I mean, and it's uncontrollable. It's like that best roller coaster ride where you can't hold it in. Unfortunately for the guys on the flight deck, mission control can hear them. So if they say anything, it comes over loops. But downstairs is great, because no one can hear us unless we push a button. So we're just screaming our heads off all the way to space. Just an amazing ride. Anyways, this is where we're headed. This is the International Space Station. So this is flying about 300 to 400 kilometers above the planet. And it's orbiting there every day. Every 90 minutes it goes around the planet. So in an hour and a half, this space station orbits the Earth. And it's a beautiful view. It's a beautiful structure. It's about the size of a football field, so it's extremely large. Has anybody seen it in the night sky? Has anybody ever looked up to see it? So a few folks. It's the brightest star at night. If you ever get a chance to look up and see it on a clear night, and you can check this on the internet, it'll tell you when the space station's passing by. You just see this really bright, beautiful star ripping across the sky. And if you take some binoculars out, sometimes you can almost make out the H pattern of the space station. So it's pretty spectacular to see it. And when you're approaching it, it's the most amazing thing, because you think, how did humans build this space station? How is it possible that we put this into space? It's every piece was built separate from each other on the ground and never connected together. They were never hooked up until they got to space. So it's an amazing feat of human engineering that we actually built this, and it's flying, and it's been flying for 13 years now. So this is the crew. When we got to space, there was 6 astronauts already on board the International Space Station, and I like to ask in this picture if you can tell which astronauts just got off the beach in Florida and which astronauts have been locked up in a space station for 6 months. You can kind of tell by the tone of their skin that we've just been from different places. But there's the space shuttle crew on the left, space station crew, on your shuttle on your right, and space station crew on the left. And we joined 3 Russians here in the middle, 2 Americans on the sides, and an Italian was already in space station when we got there. We brought an Italian with us, Roberto Battori, lower right-hand side there. So we had 2 Italians in space at the same time and 3 Russians with us. So 12 people in space on the space station. It's a wonderful place to work. It's also a wonderful place to enjoy while you're up there. There's some instruments up there. We had some fun. You get a little bit of downtime. For the most part, though, we're extremely busy. We're working basically 12 hours a day, sometimes more, trying to get all our tasks done. And when you're doing spacewalks, the days are even longer. Essentially, the only thing you can guarantee in space when you're working there is that that they've allotted an 8-hour sleep period. The rest of the time, you're pretty much on the hook to get things done and make sure that all the activities that you have to do each and every day are carried out. So we occasionally will find time to make a break, but for the most part, we're staying pretty busy. This is the reason that our space shuttle mission, Space Shuttle Atlantis, actually flew in space. This is the Alpha Magnetic Spectrometer. This is sitting in the back of the shuttle payload bay, Shuttle Endeavour. This is about the location that we placed the Hubble Space Telescope in when we went to work. But for this mission, this Alpha Magnetic Spectrometer actually came to space with us. This is a $2 billion scientific experiment that was worked on over 16 years by 16 different nations. Our shuttle flight was never supposed to fly in space, but because of international pressures and all the involvement and money that was spent on this scientific payload, Congress enacted a bill that forced this mission into space so that we could get this scientific payload up onto the International Space Station. And this is essentially the reason we did it, was to learn about space, to learn about the cosmic energy in space. And I've been fortunate, I was very fortunate to be involved with both the Hubble mission and this mission. Hubble is a telescope that can see essentially light rays in space. It can see objects that we could see with our eyes if we were close enough to them, but it shows us basically things that have light rays or light energy. The Alpha Magnetic Spectrometer is attempting to look at charged cosmic particles, so cosmic rays and cosmic particles. These two things can work together to understand more and more about the universe. So Hubble told us a couple of things. It told us that the universe is accelerating, and it also gave us some idea that there's something out there called dark energy and dark matter. There's something else in space that Hubble can't see that is the cause of what's actually happening in the universe, the expansion of the universe. So there's something called dark matter, the matter in space that actually holds everything together, and there's something called dark energy that's trying to push that all apart. So the alpha magnetic spectrometer is trying to understand what is dark matter, what is dark energy, what is antimatter. And so if you think about the makeup of the universe, the cosmos, and you make a pie chart, Hubble can see 4% of what's out there. That little green sliver is what light rays are. That's what Hubble can see. The rest of the stuff that makes up the cosmos is dark matter and dark energy. And that's why we flew the Alpha Magnetic Spectrometer, was to try to understand what are those things, what is it that makes up the rest of the universe. That's my lesson in astrophysics. I'm a seismologist. Some or most of that may be true, but hopefully I got it pretty close. But it's a mini lesson on space. Okay, we also did some spacewalks while we were out there, and that's really my job as a spacewalker. I said I was a mechanic for 3 years before I went to Purdue. That's probably why I got selected as an astronaut, not because I'm a geophysicist. I'm not really sure, but it certainly has helped me in my career, having that technical aptitude to go outside and make repairs. I like to show this photo because it gives you a sense of scale of the space station. These are the truss segments that hold the solar arrays. Remember the first picture, the big H pattern? The solar arrays are on the side. These are the trusses that hold them together. And you can see how big astronauts are when they're climbing out on the truss. So that's me hanging out on the top of that structure near the Alpha Magnetic Spectrometer, which is shown in the foreground of the picture, carrying out some activities. And my spacewalking partner on this day was Greg Shamatoff, also with some Montreal ties to the Fairmont Bagel Company. Greg Shamatoff's cousin, first cousin, is the owner of the Fairmont Bagel Company, right? Does anybody know what that is? Fairmont Bagel? Yeah, Greg's cousin. Great, great place. So we did 5 spacewalks on this mission. This is a great photo. This is actually Greg Shamatoff in the photo, but if you look in the reflection, you can see another astronaut who's taken the picture, and that's Michael Fink, one of our crew members. Michael Fink is the American who spent the most time in space, something like 389 days over 2 space station, 6-month space station missions and our space shuttle flight. So, but this was taken near the end of our spacewalks at the last of our 4 spacewalks when we completed all the activities that we had planned. And we had a very successful mission, 16 days total in duration and with the 4 spacewalks, and we got a lot of done. We got a lot completed with Alpha Magnetic Spectrometer loaded up on the truss as well. The images we see of Earth are beautiful from space, especially at night. It's magical, and you can see these night lights on the Earth. Those are actual colors, the greens and the yellows and the purples, and it really just depends on what part of the Earth you're flying over, what cities you're flying over, how they're lit up at night, and they're just some spectacular images. And it's hard for us to even convey what they look like except in pictures, because it's really hard to put words to what we see. But we also get some great daytime photos. So if you look at this photo closely, you might recognize where we're at. And it might be difficult to see because of the lighting in here. I don't know if we can bring it down anymore. But this is Michigan here, the hand. This is Detroit down in the corner. This would be Lake Huron, Lake Erie, Lake Ontario up in the top right of the photo. And so Niagara Falls is about in the middle here somewhere. And, of course, Montreal. We can zoom in a little bit more. And another photo taken. This is the top of Lake Ontario. Trenton, Belleville, Wolf Island, and then getting up towards Montreal, and then a nice close-up of Montreal taken from space. These photos were actually taken on Expedition 37, which is in space right now, which is by a fellow classmate of mine, Karen Nyberg. And so these photos were just taken a few months ago, but it's a great close-up of Montreal where we're all sitting right now. That photo was taken from about 300 kilometers up. So here's the International Space Station as we left it. Our mission, we were the last shuttle-based spacewalking crew to ever visit the space station. And this photo was taken with the space shuttle docked at the top of this photo. This is the first and the last time there's ever been a picture of the space station with a space shuttle docked to it, mainly because we don't fly space shuttles anymore, and no one had ever taken a picture before. So while we were there, 3 of those crew members that were on the space station departed. They got in their Russian Soyuz space capsule, and they returned to Earth. But when they departed from the space station, before they left the orbit, they actually started firing off a bunch of pictures of the space station with the space shuttle attached. So this was a historical image and one way to capture the union between these two space vehicles and really show the history. I mean, the space station could not have been built without the space shuttle and its capabilities in bringing all those pieces and parts up into space and having spacewalkers go outside and connect them all together. So after our 16 days in space, it was time for us to come home. And this isn't our flight, but this is actually STS-135, the last space shuttle mission. This photo was taken from the space station. That trail you see, that stream of light, is actually plasma, hot plasma gas. That's the space shuttle re-entering the Earth's atmosphere as it's coming home. And the other thing that's really cool about this picture is it shows Earth's atmosphere. So on Earth, we talk a lot about the atmosphere of the Earth, and we have to protect Earth's atmosphere, and it's really important. And the reason is because the atmosphere of our Earth is basically our spacecraft in space. It's what keeps us alive on our planet. And this is the atmosphere, this thin green band across the top of the planet. When people talk about the atmosphere and we look up in the sky, we go, well, I don't really see it. I just see blue sky. Well, from space, you can see it, and that's what it looks like. And it's a thin shell, which is almost like an eggshell around our planet. So when you think about protecting the environment and taking good care of the planet, that's what you're trying to protect, because that's what basically keeps us alive. It's like me wearing a spacesuit going outside in the vacuum of space. I can't survive without it. Earth can't survive without this, so that's a environmental plug for me. 16 days, we had to come home. We landed at night at the Kennedy Space Center, which was great. I was happy to be back in Florida. I'll say that it was a little bit disappointing for the family because on our first flight, my first flight to the Hubble Space Telescope, we waited, we were in orbit for 13 days. And 3 of those days, we were actually trying to come home, but we couldn't come home because the weather was horrible in Florida. So we waited and waited and waited, and eventually we had to land in California, which meant that our family who was waiting for us in Florida didn't get to see us when we landed, so they were all pretty disappointed. So this time we thought, excellent, we're flying, we're going to land in Florida, we're going to see our families, and then they said, but it's going to be at 2 o'clock in the morning. And so it was pitch black. So they didn't see anything. They didn't see the shuttle coming in from, 50 miles away. All they saw was this black runway, and then all of a sudden the space shuttle went, went ripping by and landed on the runway, and that was it. So I think you guys got cheated a little bit with the landings. Was that? I know I was disappointed for them. But anyways, we landed, had a great flight. Here's everybody happy, glad to be back home, successful mission, standing in front of Endeavor. It looks like we're all, happy holding hands here and good to be home, but the reality is we're all holding each other up because when you spend 2 weeks in space, you feel like you just got off of a merry-go-round, and we're all about to fall over in this picture, so it's really important to kind of support your buddy. Okay, that was a short recap of STS-134. My plan is to show you about a 12-minute video, and then, wait, let me answer a few more things first, and then I'll show you a quick video. I want to talk about what's next. We're not flying space shuttles anymore. We retired those. Our flight was the second to last, and then Space Shuttle Atlantis flew a couple months later. That was the last mission. They're all retired. This is how we get to space right now. We fly with the Russians on the Russian Soyuz rocket. About every 6 months, 4 to 6 months, we launch a new crew into space. Typically, there's 1 or 2 Americans on board that mission, or Canadians as well. We're paying the Russians. Anybody who flies on a Russian spacecraft is paying about $60 million a seat. It sounds like a lot, but it's actually not that that bad. But the point is we're paying money in other places where we could maybe be doing that from our own soil. So there are at least 3 companies involved in building commercial spacecraft, Sierra Nevada, Boeing, and SpaceX. SpaceX is one of the most popular. They've also built a cargo craft to get us into space. And as astronauts, we're really excited about the progress these folks have been making, because what it means is better access to space for all humans, and we hope that they're all successful, because NASA doesn't have shuttles anymore, so we'd rather fly in space on rockets that were built on our own soil than travel to Russia to fly on theirs. Not saying it's anything wrong with that program. We have a fantastic international program. The Russians are up there working as hard as we are, but we're looking forward to some new spacecraft. And NASA's actually working on their own spacecraft as well. We're building another vehicle that would not take us to the, well, could take us to the space station, but really the goal of NASA's new craft is to take us to the moon or Mars or to an asteroid. So we're calling this a heavy lift deep space exploration vehicle, and someday we hope to be able to have a chance to ride on this. It may not be in my career, but I think it would be, if for any of you that might be getting involved or thinking about getting involved in aerospace, there's a high likelihood that these vehicles will be flying within the next 10 years. We've got our fingers crossed for that progress, and maybe one day getting humans back on the moon again and then off eventually to Mars. Futuristic stuff. I don't think Mars is going to happen in my career, but I think in my lifetime we'll see humans with their feet on Mars. So now I'm going to show you a quick video, then we'll open it up to question and answer. So I think we got some time for question and answer.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, I was just going to thank you for your wonderful presentations. We do have time for questions. But as I was watching the landing, what was going through my mind was, I wonder how this feels for Indra, Ari, and Drew to see it again. Mm. And it must bring back all sorts of emotions and feelings.
My heart is in my throat again.
Yeah. You have an opportunity to ask questions now, and I just want to remind you that you can talk into the microphone by pressing the button right in front of you. And so, over to them.
Hi. I really enjoyed your talk, and I'd just like to echo that I'm a Francophone who went to McGill pushed by my aunt, who's a physician in New York. And although I did all my studies in French, from New York, she knew McGill's the place to go. And I took a leap of faith, because as a French speaker, to do an undergraduate at McGill, when I intended to go into medical school,
wow,
was quite a... And as you mentioned, I did not have the grades, but I aced the interview, such that, you know, coming from McGill and, you know, presenting myself at the interview was a combination that really got me into medical school and just in Montreal, and now I'm on faculty as a specialist at U of T. So certainly I can vouch for the name of McGill. Yeah.
Very good. Amazing.
When the space shuttle is re-entering the atmosphere, at what point do you begin to feel the deceleration?
That's a good question. So I think, you know, basically we're starting to feel when gravity starts to take over again. And we have something called entry interface, which is at 400,000 feet, I believe. And that's when we can start to feel things getting heavy. And I can tell you that I was holding, when we were in space, we have these little video repeaters. And they're very small. I mean, they're about the size of this box here. And I was holding that in my hand. And as we started to come back into Earth's gravity, eventually that thing got so heavy that I couldn't hold it anymore. So I had it on my knee for a while, and then it started hurting my knee, so I had to finally put it on the ground. But the reality is the thing only weighs like 2 pounds. But because I spent 2 weeks in space not holding anything or feeling the weight of anything, that was unbearably heavy for me to hold up. And so at about 400,000 feet, we start feeling that gravity, and eventually you're in the full force of gravity. And we actually pull a little more than 1G on entry. It's like 1.2 or 1.3, so it's pretty mild. But so we go a little bit over 1G, but it settles back down, but everything becomes extremely heavy. And then, of course, your body's really heavy, too, and standing up is a big challenge after you land in space.
These are our kids here, and this is Finian. And I think since he was three, he's wanted to be an astronaut. And on April 28th or 29th of 2011, we sat at the launch pad, and it got scrubbed. A heater issue or something, I remember.
Sorry.
No.
We were there, too.
We went to the Keys for a week, and that was part of our vacation, and he was very disappointed. But I bet you that this has made up for it. Yeah. Meeting one of the guys.
A respected McGill student as well?
Yes.
Come to McGill.
In the right place. Yeah.
I'm interested in becoming an astronaut, but I wonder how to prepare for that. Let's say, do all of your colleagues have at least a private pilot license?
Not necessarily. Many of them do, and the reason is because we fly aircraft. But I think a lot of what's behind the private pilot's license is a way to assess a person's abilities and understand that they are comfortable in working in operational environments. So as astronauts, we don't necessarily get hired because of our previous professions. I'm a seismologist. You don't do seismology from the space shuttle. We do some Earth observations with photos, and we certainly do that from the space station, but I don't do geophysics from space, at least not right now. If we start exploring the moon again and Mars, eventually maybe that would come into play. But astronauts become trained to operate spacecraft. That's what we do. We consider ourselves operators. Just like somebody in the military would operate a submarine or a tank or a vehicle, or somebody working in the mining industry might operate a large rock hauler or a scraper or something, you know, operational equipment. So learning to become a pilot just is basically self-training, but also an awareness of what your skills are as an operator. So I'd recommend it if you're interested in being an astronaut, but do other things as well. Like, we spend a lot of time underwater training, so many people get scuba certified. Because that's important in the line of work we do, but that's also an operational task. If you're a scientist or you work in a laboratory, it's really important to have great hands-on experience, because all of the what we call payloads or experiments are in space involve us, you know, require us to read checklists and operate equipment that we have no familiarity with, I mean, very little. And a lot of what you do relies on your skill-based knowledge, not your specific task-based knowledge where someone's trained you how to, you know, move something from point A to point B, but your understanding of why you're doing that or why you would do that
is based on the skills that you developed before you got there.
And I've heard Drew say before that he never really had a plan. I'm going to do this, then this, then this to become an astronaut. Follow your heart, follow your passions. A lot of the astronauts, male and female, you read their bios, very interesting things, right? Hikers, you know, whatever it is, follow your passion, be happy doing what you're doing. If it leads you to that path, that's great. If it leads you somewhere else, that's great too.
While you're following your academic career in geophysics and seismology, was being an astronaut always in your mind, or did that just happen naturally?
Being an astronaut was always in my mind at that time. Hey, Liam.
Siggy.
See you guys. I had always wanted to do that. I really did. But I never, as my wife said, I never really did things that drove me to it. I just did what seemed natural in my career path. But I think having that goal, you know, we like to tell people, like, if you have a goal, hold on to it. Those are the things that get you to where you want to be. You can do, you know, people saying, oh, you can do anything you want. And I was like, yeah, whatever. Like, everybody says that. And my parents always tell me, you can do whatever you want. But I'm pretty sure now that you really can do whatever you want, because I did it. You know, I went from community college. I didn't have great grades in high school. I had to go to community college. I was a mechanic. I wasn't really sure how everything was going to, you know, lead to one, from one thing to another, but it did. And I think it did because I had that goal. It was planted somewhere in my head, that little seed that said, I think when I grow up, humans are going to be going to space and I'm going to be one of them. And I just kept going down that road and eventually I got there. So it's important to have that seed planted.
Tell them what happened when you met me, though.
Well, a lot of things happened.
No, tell them which one.
But,
the grades?
I was forced to spend more time in the library to date her because that's where she was. So I don't know.
And his grades went up, and that helped you.
That made a big difference.
Do you have another question right over here from the young gentleman? You? Yes, you?
Were you ever scared while you were in space?
Absolutely. Yes, I was scared out of my wits. Especially the first time I launched in space. That was the most scary moment, one of the most scary moments of my life. Because I wasn't sure in the next 8 minutes if I was going to live or die. There was only two answers to that question. And also, we had a lot of alarms that went off on my first launch that I didn't know about. I wasn't really ready for those things because I mentioned that I didn't spend a lot of time training in the simulator. I was underwater training in my spacesuit. So when I got into the spacecraft, all the alarms that went off after we launched were very familiar to the guys that spent all their time doing the malfunction simulations, not to me. So I was downstairs in the bottom part of the shuttle wondering, like, you know, are we going to blow up next? And this is going to be a very short space mission. But fortunately, we did. So I've been scared in space more than just that time. But yes, we get scared in space.
I would like to know, what's the most difficult part to being an astronaut for you?
I'd say, you know, the most challenging is the physical challenges of training for a spacewalk. When we train in the underwater pool, we spend about 6 hours in that suit. And in the water, although it's neutrally buoyant, it still does weigh 300 pounds. And we spend a lot of effort moving against the friction of the water. And the suits don't fit very well. It makes your fingers a little bit sore. It really beats up your body. So if you spend multiple days in a row over 2 or 3 years training in that spacesuit, it can be pretty grueling. There are some other challenges as well, but the job is really enjoyable, so I really don't like to complain about any of it, because it's really hard to do that.
That's right. One thing that I couldn't help thinking is psychologically, you know, how do people keep their wits about them? I'm thinking, you know, you're a closed space of teammates, one woman, seven men. I'm just thinking in terms of, you know, the long I was working. How do you keep your mind?
It's the training. It's repetitive training. I mean, just like for any task you do, I mean, it's like taking a test, right? The way you prepare for taking a test is you, like, just do problems over and over and over and over again until you're ready to throw up. I mean, that's the same way spaceflight is. We trained for 3 years for the Hubble mission. Every day training the same thing over and over and over again. So eventually, the actions you're taking are all in your, it's muscle memory, you call it, you know, that they're automatic. And so that when other things start to happen that are not normal, then your brain has the capacity to understand and process those things and deal with them. So psychologically, though, like for the first time when you go out to do a spacewalk, yeah, you're frozen. I mean, I went out and I was overwhelmed by the fact that all I could see beneath me was the Earth, and I'm holding on to the spaceship, and I'm like, hey, this is stupid. What am I doing outside? But then, you know, then immediately after that, 1 second, I thought, okay, if I move, I'm going to fall. I'm going to fall down to Earth because, you know, gravity works, and I'm up here, and the Earth is down there. Normally you fall. But the second I let go with my other hand, I realized I wasn't going to fall. And then the 3 years of training took over. It was like, okay, you have 6.5 hours to get a lot of work done. And if you don't get your work done, then tomorrow those guys will be behind. And the next day you'll be behind. And it's a domino effect. And so the training takes over. And it's just like the training you do in school. You have to repeat things over and over and over again so that they're just drilled into your mind.
And one of Mark Kelly's twin brother is going to go up into space for a year, and your question has relevance, psych support, right? A year, you guys, some of the astronauts say it's like flying in a tin can, right? Think about that. So they build in psych support for the astronauts as well. And, you know, there's videos, there's phone calls, there's email, there's all that. So that's very important too, I'd say.
How did you go from Exxon to NASA? Just send in an application?
I did, yeah. A whole lot of luck. You know, living in Houston, much to my wife's dismay, we realized we were a couple of miles from the Johnson Space Center, which is the human spaceflight training center. And so every 2 to 5 years, NASA has an astronaut selection opportunity, and I filled out an application, and it's the biggest application of my life. You know, it's pages and pages, volumes of paperwork, and a lot of effort to get it delivered, but essentially filled out an application and was just very lucky to get it selected. And that's the way the process works today as well.
What are you planning to do with your career now?
That's a good question. What am I planning to do? I'm still an active astronaut. I'm still active in the astronaut corps. I'm still eligible for spaceflight. So I might be waiting for another spaceflight assignment.
Annie Glenn actually said to John Glenn one of the last times, that's it, no. She actually said no.
I haven't heard no yet. No. I also haven't heard no from NASA. So I'm essentially in line for space flight, but nothing assigned yet. And there's a chance that maybe that time will lapse and be too long, and I'll go on to do something else, and I don't know what that is. Next time I might have job resumes. Go ahead.
Is the runway for when the shuttle's landing a lot longer than a normal jet runway?
It is. It's so the shuttle can land on multiple runways. In general, I think we have a minimum runway length of 10,000 feet, which is a pretty long runway for most airplanes. But the runway we normally land on, that we like to land on, is 15,000 feet long. So it's about 3 miles long. It's a really long runway. But we can land on, I think, as short as like 8 or 10,000 feet. We don't like to do that, but we can.
That's a good question.
There's a lot of what we call contingency landing sites around the world for the space shuttle, so we could land in just about any country. But it's a specific airport that we have to make it to because of the runway length. So we're looking back. In the back.
Yeah, this may sound like a silly question, but how do you work out in space since there's no mass?
Yeah, it's not a silly question, and it's an excellent question, because astronauts who are in space for 6 months have a requirement to work out 3 hours a day. And we have two treadmills that they can use, and they use those by getting strapped down with cables and bungee cords. It actually is a harness that you wear in your body like a backpack that pulls you down onto the treadmill, and you run against that load. So you can set different loads of your body weight to hold you down. And we also have a resistive exercise device machine, which is like a Soloflex or Bowflex. It's basically working against rubber bands or dashpots where, you know, if you're pulling a rubber band, it's going to pull back, right? So it's a whole elaborate system that is designed to allow you to do major muscle groups and some finer muscle groups as well. And astronauts use those 3 hours a day. We also have a cycle ergometer, essentially a bicycle, you know, stationary bike that we ride. And that is probably mechanically the most simple, right? Because you just have to keep yourself strapped to the seat and your legs can do all the work. So there's a number of different ways that we exercise, and it's a very important medical requirement for us to do that 3 hours a day. And the reason we do that is because we're trying to reduce the effects of low gravity on our bones. So what happens when you're in space is that the nutrients that go to your bones stop receiving programming to feed your bones because the lower extremities of your body aren't supporting your weight anymore. So your bone structure changes, your muscles change because you don't use your legs anymore. So the nerves, your nervous system stops telling your body to feed nutrients to those parts of your anatomy. And so if we run on treadmills or use resistive exercise devices, we can stimulate those parts of our anatomy to actually feed nutrients and keep our bone mass, keep our bones strong, keep the mass up, and keep our muscles strong too. The man in the back.
So did you lose muscle mass when you were in space?
I did. Yeah, a little bit. But for short missions, both of my missions were only 2 weeks long. So it was a pretty small reduction in muscle mass and bone density change. But it is slight and it is measurable. For the astronauts that are in space longer, in the early stages of the space station program, for the first 5 years or so, we weren't very good at keeping their muscle strong and their bone density high. Now we've overcome that, and astronauts are coming back actually a little bit stronger and with about the same body mass and bone density. Although, even with those advances, we do see that the microcrystalline structure of the bones still change. Even if they maintain the same density, the structure changes slightly.
Thanks.
We don't really understand that yet. And I'm not a doctor, so go ahead.
Do astronauts, or you need to have a specific things or habits in their regular life, everyday life, to continue being able to go to space, like food habits or?
Not really. Most of us, I think, try to stay fit just because of the requirements of the job. And most astronauts try to stay healthy. There are no American astronauts, for example, that smoke cigarettes. There are Russian cosmonauts that do smoke cigarettes. Part of that is culture, so there are differences between the way astronauts and cosmonauts, for example, train. It's not true of all other foreign nation astronauts.
And you have to keep up your flight hours.
Yeah, we have requirements for flight hours and simulators that we have to do, but for the most part, like personal habits, drinking, eating, and stuff, you're kind of on your own, but you want to stay in the game, so it's a good idea to stay fit and stay on track.
I think we have one more question, and then maybe we'll wrap up.
Yeah, you were talking earlier about the future of space flight. Now that the space shuttle is decommissioned, and you were saying that you might not be able to experience yourself going in your career, going to Mars or to the Moon. But what, from your point of view in the field, what do you think about organizations such as Mars One that are like planning, have big objectives such as Mars in 2022 or something like that?
I'm very supportive of those initiatives, and I think all astronauts are. I mean, most of us are in this program because we believe that humans should have access to space and that we as humans should be exploring space and other planets within our solar system. So I don't know how successful they'll be. Flying spacecraft into space is not easy. That's why NASA, that's why government agencies up until very recently have been the only ones able to do that. It takes a lot of money and a lot of effort by people. So we're supportive of those initiatives, and I think, in the next decade or two, we're going to see a lot more of that and probably some successes and some people, other customers for commercial spacecraft besides NASA. So SpaceX is not only building a spacecraft to go to the space station, but they're also building a heavy lift rocket that is not intended to be used by NASA, but somebody else. And my guess is there will be paying customers that will try to utilize that asset and go to space.
Is there showers in space?
Excellent question. There are no showers in space, but we do take sponge baths. And so if you know what a sponge bath is, there's water in space and there's sponges and washcloths, and so that's how we shower, is we get these washcloths and sponges wet and we wipe down our bodies and wipe some soap on it and we wash it off with a washcloth, and that's how we bathe.
Seriously, think about Scott Kelly. When's he launching?
In 2 years.
In 2 years, for a year.
A year in space without
shock. That's going to be the longest for a U.S. astronaut.
You don't want to open that capsule.
I have one question myself before we thank you for talking. One thing I noticed is that you couldn't have done this alone. Indra could not have pursued the career she had that she has alone. That's true for me, and I'm sure that's true for most of us. And so it really does take the support of family mm-hmm. and friends. The team who went into space with you and the team on the ground. And so in saying that, I want to say just acknowledge your family and friends who are here today
Absolutely.
Supporting you. And thank you for being here as well. So thank you very much. I would like to know, how does a family prepare? How did the Feustel family prepare for Dad to go into space? What kind of teamwork did that take? Can you describe to us?
I'm going to leave that to my son.
Okay.
Let's hear it.
Well, honestly, up until the point that he finally launched, I think it was kind of a surreal thing for me. I had noticed, definitely for the first mission, I had kind of put it out of my head that he was going until the point that he left. So it's a little bit of a coping thing, I guess, is where you kind of... I knew it was going to happen, but you try not to think about it too much until it's already been there, done that. So the second mission was a little bit easier because you kind of know what to expect, but, you know, it's nerve-wracking either way. But it's good that we're all in it together kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. And you're absolutely right. I do want to thank my family and friends because you do. You need those supports. And, you know, they came down to Florida. And we had a reception.
More than once.
And if it wasn't for seeing their sweet, lovely faces, to calm me down, and it's about sharing, right? Life is about sharing, and we're so happy to be able to share it with our family and friends, and share it with all of you.
I can tell you one thing. And you mentioned going to the launch and having to leave, and a lot of our families and friends did that as well. From an astronaut's perspective. As we were driving towards the launch pad and we turned the bus around, the only thing that every astronaut in that van was worried about was their family and friends. We were all so disappointed because we knew mm-hmm. how many people put how much money, effort, and time just to be there to support us and see it for themselves. And we knew they all were going to go home. And it was really disappointing for us. So we recognize every day, and you heard Mark Kelly talking at the end of our mission, making those speeches, basically saying, hey, we're just the lucky guys on the end of the arrow, you know, we lucky or not, however you want to think of it, but it's all the people on the ground, our family, all the support teams that put us in the space, we're just fortunate to be able to see it.
I just want to say that I remember thinking those guys are sitting, you know, what I imagine in the top of that machine going, no, there's no taking off if there's a wire missing, or
right.
if something's mm-hmm. missing, then...
We knew we couldn't go, but the thing we felt the worst about was that everybody that was there was going to have to go home.
So
that
close, was the only right? Thing
that was
so
on our
close.
Mind. How many people are getting turned away now? Mm-hmm.
Thank you. I just want to thank the Feustel family for the talks today. It was wonderful to hear about that perfect parent, alumna, and career, your own education, and as well as the life of a family supporting an astronaut. Andrew, for you to hear about your experiences in space is amazing. So, and I'd like to just say that whatever career path you're imagining for yourselves, what I loved was the idea that it's about passion. So thank you for sharing that. It's about pursuing what you love, what matters to you, always thinking about it as something that you're doing one step at a time. It's not all at once. It builds over a lifetime of experiences.
And it can go like this.
And the path, yeah, that's right. And so as you're thinking about what you want to study, think of it as just one step along that journey, and take the advice that Indra provided to you about passion, following your passion. So thank you both very much. Thank you, Ari, as well. And we're really grateful that you could be here today.
Thank you.